Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Joe Flanagan filling in for Kathy Lewis. Yep, it's me. Kathy asked, and I said yes. I took a crack at plenty of jobs during my 3 decades at WVEC, but the one I just can't seem to get the hang of is retirement. And one job I never tried is this one, an hour-long radio call-in show. Are you kidding? So here I am, once again indulging my longtime love affair with broadcasting. But thankfully, I get to skip the makeup chair this time. Since I'm back doing a job I love, the Hearsay team thought it'd be a great chance to talk with you, our listeners, about the jobs you love. So join us at 440-2665 with your stories about your land, how you landed that dream job or that memorable moment when it stopped being a career and became your calling. We got Hollywood film directors, sports general managers, but first the news. Joe Flanagan back in here live, sitting in for Kathy, trying to do the best I can on this new world of doing this radio show. And all ears and eyes are on the weather, as we know, with Hurricane Matthew making its way gradually towards the state of Florida. We have Terry Smith on the line, a meteorologist with the Weather Channel. Terry, what's the latest on Hurricane Matthew?
Well, the latest is that Matthew continues to strengthen. It started strengthening overnight, and it continues to do so. And now it's up to a Category 4 hurricane in terms of the wind speed, the sustained winds at 140 miles an hour. It's possible it could strengthen a little bit further today and tonight, but it won't. I don't think it'll get beyond a Category 4. But it's heading through the Bahamas and working its way toward the southeast coast of Florida. And I think the folks in southeast Florida will start to feel the impacts, at least tropical storm force winds and some of the rain, starting tonight and then continuing through the day tomorrow and tomorrow night. And then the hurricane expected to make its way up the east coast of Florida toward Georgia and South Carolina late Friday into Saturday.
Yeah, we're hearing evacuations in southeast Georgia and South Carolina. How's North Carolina looking in all this?
You know what? I have not followed all the evacuations myself personally. I'm aware of some of the mandatory evacuations in Brevard County, Florida, and some of the voluntary ones that have taken place north up toward Jacksonville and the coast of Georgia as well. But I have not heard anything yet in terms of any evacuations taking place in North Carolina.
Okay. And then the storm expected to turn east by the time it gets closer to us. So basically Hampton Roads is looking better than we were a few days ago.
Yeah, it doesn't. I don't think we're going to see any sort of direct impacts from Matthew. We do have a cold front that's heading in our direction. It will bring us some rain over the weekend. And it's that same cold front that's going to kind of push the hurricane away from the coastline starting sometime Saturday, more so Sunday. I think that hurricane will still be swimming around out there in the Atlantic early next week in a weakened state. So it'll be interesting to continue to monitor it and see how it holds together and where it goes. But starting at about Sunday, we should see the impacts, the heavy rain and the winds that are problematic beginning to ease up. The seas will still be running high. There still may be some beach erosion that may be a problem early next week, but the hurricane will be a little bit further away from the coastline.
All right, Terry Smith with the Weather Channel, thank you so much for that update. We do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We're back here now talking a little bit about the various jobs that yours truly got to do. I say got to do. I had a blast for 30 years going out and about, and butchers, bakers, candlestick makers. We tried to try them all and shine a little spotlight on people who normally don't get a spotlight shined on them. Some people loved what they did, and we discovered some people didn't like so much what they did. But we've got a guy in our studio right now that I can't wait to talk to. You might say he found his dream job, and perhaps on this latest film project that he's working on, maybe his dream film project as well. He's Derek Bort. You may have heard the name before. Derek, a local guy, went to First Colonial High School. Oorah, oorah, my three children, graduates of FC. Derek's in the studio. Derek, good morning or good afternoon. Great to have you here.
Oh, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
You have hit a home run. 2009, your movie The Joneses was a success. But this latest one, London town is very interesting, involving kind of a coming to life issue with a young man and the band The Clash from back in the day, the punk band The Clash, which you personally have a fascination with. Tell us about this.
Well, I guess to start with the band, I mean, I was at Lynn Haven Junior High School in around 1980 or so, and had a couple friends that gave me a cassette and said I had to listen to this. Popped it in, and it was The Clash, for their first album. And within a few minutes, I knew that this was the music that I was supposed to be listening to. So thus began my lifelong relationship with the music of the band. And fast forward some 20 years or more, maybe, my agent's asking me what my dream project would be. And just off the cuff, I kind of just threw out, I'd love to find a film about a young kid discovering The Clash.
Wow.
Not thinking there would be any response other than a laugh or something. And he said, hey, there's a project out there exactly like this. I'll send it over to you. You can read the script. And I read it, loved it, and met with the producers. They loved my take on it. And 5 or 6 years of hard work later, we made the film.
It's unbelievable. Morgan, our producer, Morgan Chase, was telling me that this project just so happened to be sitting there as you brought it up. How uncanny, the karma, the luck. That was awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely strange how these things work. You know, I think that a lot of people may have thought about a biopic or something for to tell The Clash's story, and I just always thought the best way to tell their story was through the effect that they and their music had on a young person, much like my experience with them.
Wow. That's so cool. I had to question myself and remember some of the songs The Clash did. And talking to a person yesterday, when I mentioned The Clash to her, the first thing out of her mouth was Rock the Casbah. Tell us some of the other titles so you can refresh our listeners into the music they were famous for.
Well, the music in my film is from their first album, which is not really as popular as some of the later Rock the Casbah type stuff that off of their later records. Like Combat Rock was a big album that when they became very popular in the U.S. But this is earlier than that. You've got White Riot and White Man and Hammersmith Palais, London's Burning. So, you know, it may not be as popular to everyone, but I think much more important music by them.
All righty. And our phone numbers, by the way, is 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. If you have a question for Derek Board, just call in and talk to him. We're having a great conversation here. And Derek, I was reading on the research that the Jonathan, is it Reese Myers?
Reese Myers.
Reese.
Yeah.
That Myers expertly portrays Strummer, the member of the band, and captures the blunt lilt of the frontman's sneer as he barrels through Clash City Rockers. Tell us about working with the actor and what that means, captured the blunt lilt.
We'd have to look that up because I don't know what blunt lilt is actually, but I think that he's captivating as Joe Strummer. He not only is an amazingly talented actor, but he's an amazing musician as well. So, you know, once he got involved with the project, we talked about how to deal with the music, and we had the rights to the music. The Clash had read the script. They approved the script and granted us the rights to all this music, but we didn't want to lip sync to these studio recordings. So then we looked at all the live recordings, and it still felt false to us. So in talking with Jonathan, working with him, we decided, let's just re-record all the music. Let's put a band together. Let's get an engineer that had worked with The Clash before, and let's re-record all of it and just be hopefully more authentic, because it's not going to be someone trying to lip sync.
Gotcha. Now your film premieres tonight at the Narrow.
It does actually. The New York, LA premieres are all tomorrow, along with 10 other cities, but because I had to leave to go to those premieres, as well as the big London premiere next week, followed by Rome, I talked to IFC Films and they worked with The Narrow and found a way to do a 1 day early premiere here in Norfolk at The Narrow, which has a you know, sort of special meaning for me as well. And I get to be there, which is wonderful. So they put it all together, and it's I think it's very cool to be premiering it here before all these other big cities.
Very cool. How did you become a film director?
Well, how much time do we have?
Yeah, right.
You know, I always love film, and I guess fast forward to undergrad at ODU, I studied painting, and I just kind of never really put the connection. I've never made the connection of actually being a filmmaker as a profession. And then somehow a friend was at film school in New York, and it sounded interesting and sounded like it really would speak to me in terms of taking what I was already doing in terms of art, multimedia art, and adding the concept of time and movement to it in such a way that was fascinating. It was interesting, and I just dove right into it and kind of haven't looked back since.
Yeah, I was talking to Tench Phillips with The Narrow yesterday a lot about you, and he said that you just thrive on working with performers. When you're there with the stars, you are in your element. Is that a great feeling for you to work with actors?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you know, I always kind of pride myself on being the dumbest guy in the room. You know, I think that surrounding yourself with great people and empowering them to do what they do best and creating that environment of collaboration is really the what makes this job so special to me, because these happy accidents that happen when you have this great environment, you know, things you weren't planning for, you prep like crazy, but then something you weren't planning for happens that makes it all even that much better. So that I do really love that part.
All right, let's take a break and talk to some folks calling in. Jeff's on the line from Norfolk. Hello, Jeff.
Hey there, Joe. Jeff Meese calling. My question is, much of that first Clash album centered around the economic conditions of England at the time, songs like Career Opportunities. So I'm wondering if that comes across in the movie, the sort of unemployment, disenfranchised youth of England during the late 1970s.
Oh, good question.
Great question. Yeah, I think that the economic situation, the racial unrest, the social situation, I think all of that is a factor in the film as the backdrop for what Shay, our protagonist, is dealing with, and as it relates to the music as well as his current situation. And you know, that was one of the big things that I liked about this script, was not only did it have this backdrop of this kind of historical context, but it also had so many parallels to what we're seeing today in terms of, well, here in the States as well as in the UK, with the racial and social issues and economic issues and the rise of Thatcher, you know, and the National Front as well. So we definitely have that as a theme throughout the entire film.
Jeff, you're going to be there tonight?
I will certainly be there tonight.
I'll look forward to seeing you. Great. Thanks for calling. Doug in Hampton. Hello.
Hey. Is this Joe?
This is Joe.
Joe, Doug Sesney.
Hey.
I was a photographer. I used to work with you for
how you
a couple of years.
How you doing, Doug?
You're sounding great, Joe. I wanted to ask Derek a question about transitioning. Did he do any film or did he just do videotape?
You know, I've worked with both. I think that, you know, I've never been a film purist, but when the situation or the project calls for it, I love working with film. I shot The Joneses on film. We shot that, on Super 35, and this particular project, we used, the Alexa. So, you know, mostly use digital these days, but I love film.
Yeah, Doug, what do you think? Any more questions?
Yeah. The way you can break the video down, which we couldn't do with film, and just manipulate it so much in three different, like, red, green, blue, and work with it, and you don't have to be on, and you have a vast latitude of lighting. Does that kind of help you do kind of different things that you didn't do on film?
Well, I think the biggest benefit that I've seen is when you shoot in 4K and you can resize and you know, blow up your image if you want to reframe and things like that in post. You know, those are the kind of things that that jump out at me, but there are definitely, you know, pros and cons. I mean, even when I shot on film, you can still digitize and cut nonlinear. So it just, I think that the end result, you pretty much get the same amount of latitude at this point. You just don't get to see exactly what you're getting on film until it's processed.
All right, Doug, thanks so much for calling in. Folks, what's your dream job? Banker? Airline pilot? Window washer? Give us a call and check in on this discussion on dream jobs for the next hour. This is Joe Flanagan with Joe's Job, and we'd like to hear from you. Maybe you love your job. Maybe you hate what you do. We want to hear from you, too. Call in 440-2665 and 1-800-940-2240. Derek Bolt, it's awesome that you can still live right here in Virginia Beach and yet do these projects that are outside of this area. What about the world of VOD, video on demand and all, and the way you market your project? Is it more challenging, or do you have a faster track to get your projects out there?
Wow, good question. You know, I think that VOD has definitely opened up possibilities where films that may not have gotten any release at all in the past because they weren't getting a theatrical release have a chance. You know, I mean, I can point to, I mean, The Joneses, for instance, when it got a smaller theatrical release, but then had a really big kind of explosion on digital, I mean, on demand, where it has, you know, over 2 million views on Netflix, that I wish they would have captured in the theater. That would have been nice, but it does provide kind of another chance for films to find an audience, which is great. Mm-hmm.
And what's the future? What's the coming down the pike for you?
Well, if I can make it through, you know, the next week of what I have going on, yeah. You know, which is you know, there's a lot going on. I mean, I think that even these things kind of are trivialized by the weather situation going on. But if I can make it through the next week of premieres in New York and London and Rome and get back to Virginia Beach, I've got a few projects lined up, and not, you never know which one's going to go. Mm-hmm. You know, you always have to have kind of multiple things happening because, you know, these things take time, you know, sometimes a few years. So you never know which one's going to happen next, but just hopefully they let me make another film.
I was kind of sort of a one of you when I got out of college, went right out to Hollywood and was hoping to figure out how to make it. Called the actor Martin Sheen back then because somewhere his grandmother knew my grandmother in Dayton, Ohio. When he answered the phone, I about choked. I'm thinking, I really got him on the phone, but he gave me the best advice. Joe, look, there's no such thing as a Hollywood. You're here. Your hardest thing is to figure out where do you fit into all this. That's what you've got to decide. If you're a dancer, go dance every day. If you're a singer, go sing. You're not coming out here to be a Soto jerk guy and get discovered. You got in your heart, you got to go do what you want to do. What's your advice? Young kids like me that are out there listening, right? Young kids like me, young kids that I used to be that are listening and maybe say, I'd love to get to Hollywood and be a director like Derek.
Well, I work with kids, students all the time, a lot at ODU here in their film department. I come in and work with them. And I always tell them the same thing, which is don't wait for permission to do the things that you want to do. You know, technology has made it so that you can make a movie on your iPhone these days. So live your life as though you're do what you're going to do, and don't wait for someone to pluck you out of obscurity to do it. I think that that's the difference. I think I know people that think or you know, they have to sit around waiting for someone to discover them and grant them this opportunity. And I think that filmmakers make films, regardless of the level of the film. You know, dancers dance, singers sing, you know, just do what you're supposed to do and do it every day, because it's not a giant step to doing it on a larger level. It's a lot of little steps. So just do it every day.
Mm-hmm. Good advice. Remind our listeners, again, this is tonight at the Narrow, the time you're going to be there and you're going to be available to discuss the project after the film.
Sure. Yeah. Tonight. So there's a few different things tonight. The film opens at the Narrow tonight. The showtime is 7:15 p.m. There'll be a Q&A afterwards. The online advance ticket sales are finished. They're sold out, but they're going to have some tickets available at the box office. But the Narrow is running the film through the weekend and through next week. So if you don't get a chance to see it tonight, you can see it through the week. And then prior to that, there's a kind of a meet and greet that Toast in Norfolk is hosting with Commonwealth Brewery, where I'm going to go down there and say hello to some people and talk film. And then after the movie, Work Release in Norfolk is also doing a an after party. So it's going to be a fun night. And then I got to be at the airport at 5 a.m.
Oh, you're kidding.
So it's going to be a fun evening, I think.
What's your sense? Will this be bigger in London than it is in the States? Or will New York be bigger than L.A.? Or will Norfolk top them all?
You know, it's so hard to tell once you put something out there to predict what the response is going to be. I think that, there are a lot of people that are expecting one version of this story of The Clash, which is that this is a gritty biopic that's dark and, portrays the band in a certain way that they're looking for. And really what it is it's a sweet coming of age story that you can bring your kids to.
Really?
And that's really, depending on what people are expecting, that's going to influence, I guess, how they respond to it. I hope it finds an audience. I think it's done really well with young people so far when we've tested it, and old people that are open to this type of story as well. Older people as well. But I don't know where it's going to play. Well, in London it may open and people may throw bottles at me. I don't know, But I'm happy that there's a passion for this band and this music. And that other people have other versions of this story that they would like to see. And, when they go out and make that film, I'll be first in line to buy a ticket for it.
Yeah.
So let's see how it goes. Hopefully it finds a great audience and introduces a new generation to this music and as well as the situation that produced this kind of music, the social and economic situation that contributed to this kind of music actually happening in the first place.
Yeah. Look forward to it, Derek. I'll be over there tonight. Thank you for coming in today.
My
Derek
pleasure.
Port,
thank
ladies
you.
Ladies and gentlemen, local Virginia Beach filmmaker doing very well with his film that premieres tonight at The Narrow, 7:15, London Town, the story of The Clash and a coming of age of a young man. Thanks, Derek. Great
Thanks
to
Thanks for
meet
having
you.
Me. Great to meet you. Thanks for having me.
You
Appreciate
bet.
It.
We'll be back, everybody. Yes, that was The Clash and a song called Bank Robber. How much we're learning about that band. And I'm going tonight. Derek Bort, who was just here, premieres the film tonight, 7:15 at the Narrow Expanded Cinema. And I want to see that movie. We are talking so much about dream jobs and Joe's job that I cranked out for so many years. And we want to hear from you. Our phone number is 440-2665-1800. 940-2240 about what you do for a living. Maybe it's something that you'd like me to come visit you on your job. We're always looking. We want to hear from you. Maybe you've got experiences from the many jobs I did. Maybe it was your job I tried. But I want to tell you this next segment, we're going to hear from Joe Gregory with the Norfolk Tides. And I picked Joe because one of the most interesting jobs I did was over at the Tides with the Bat Boys. And I'd seen a documentary on Fenway Park. I think it was on public television. And in the documentary, it said every single Major League Baseball team has each and every one of their baseballs rubbed with a dash of mud before every game. I couldn't believe it. Every team, they say, has done this since the 40s. And they said even in minor leagues, this is done. So I called the Tides. They verified it. Oh, yes, 85 to 90 balls before every single Tides game when they're pulled out of the package, they get a certain dash of mud rubbed up against them just to add a little more grip for the pitcher. And this mud doesn't come from anywhere. This mud comes from the same swamp, producer, manufacturer, whatever, that started this process back in the 40s. An unbelievable story. And we did the Joe's job with the guy rubbing the mud on the balls. There was even a major league pitcher from Cincinnati Reds who had come down. I forget his name. He was from Ocean Lakes High School. But he verified the point that, oh, yeah, we need that little dash for that grip. So the story was fascinating. I think I even won a meritorious award from the AP on that one. But we wanted to elaborate a little bit on this whole idea with Joe Gregory, who's vice president, general manager of the Norfolk Tides, and he joins us on the phone. Hello, Joe.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Oh, great. I'm glad you're here. Fellow Buckeye, born and raised in Youngstown, Ohio. We've met many times.
Yes, sir.
What about this? You've seen the guys and you know the process, and I'm not lying to anybody. They do this at every major league game and every minor league game, right?
Yeah. We had one tub of this rubbing mud that shows up just prior to the season. We don't know where it comes from exactly. You know, like you said, certain part of a river in New Jersey where they extract this mud and distribute it to every team in the majors and minors, and we get the one tub and pass that along to our visiting clubby. And you know, it's from then on out, every baseball that's thrown, you know, across all of the country during the season is rubbed down with that same mud.
Unbelievable. I was so hoping that the Baltimore Orioles would have continued in the playoffs and we could have been talking about them tonight, since that is your parent club, but bong, they're gone. And also then the Mets last night, I thought, well, Mets used to be the parent club here. Bong, they're gone. What'd you think of those two losses?
Yeah, both tough days for Tigers affiliates, former and current, but you know, saw great pitching in both those games. You know, last night, you know, came right down to the wire, and you know, Baumgartner just continues to be the great postseason pitcher that he is, you know, going up against Syndergaard. And, you know, the Orioles, it was a tough loss, you know, going extra innings there and another duel. But you know, it just shows how important, you know, every pitch is, every game is. You know, came down right to the wire with the Orioles to see if they were going to be playing in Toronto or Baltimore. But, so much happened, so many games are played, but it comes down to the smallest of margins at the end of the day.
Yeah, we don't want to continue as an all-sports call-in talk show with our discussion here, Joe, but the theme is really dream jobs. Do you consider your job as a dream job for you?
Oh, for sure. You know, I'm lucky to be working in pro sports. It's something I've been doing, you know, realistically since I was probably 15. So many people get to, go to a game here and there, but, you know, I get to go to every baseball game in Norfolk and, you know, get my free pass that gets me into every major league game. And, you know, it really is, you know, I'm a lucky man to be, you know, getting paid to do something that I love.
Oh, good for you. Let's listen to one of our callers, Chelsea, see if she's got a dream job. Hello, Chelsea. I think you want to actually talk about the Clash that we've been discussing?
Yeah. Hey, nice to be on the air with you.
Thanks for having me. Thank you.
So, yeah, I grew up, my mom was in the punk scene when she was younger, and I grew up as a baby listening to the Ramones and the Clash, and that had a big influence on my life musically, like, you know, growing up with that. So I wish I could go see the movie tonight because that would be awesome because I love The Narrow. However, my dream job I have is a flight attendant, so I have to leave today.
Oh, ho, ho. And that is your dream job.
It is indeed. I dropped out of college to start flying as a flight attendant, and I love it. So it kind of answers both of your topics here.
Yeah, a good friend of our family's is a flight attendant. Her mother is also a flight attendant, and they both served on the same flights before with Southwest Air. How long a process was it for you to get involved in that, and how passionate have you been about it?
I've been very passionate. I started out at one airline, but I my main goal was to fly for Southwest Airlines, and it took me about 4 years to get hired by Southwest, and I finally did. So here I am.
And what is it you enjoy so much about it? I mean, a couple flights for me, cross country, thank you, good night, I want to go home. I can't imagine that every day you do that for a living. That's got to be a challenge.
It is. It's a challenge, like, on your personal life, family life, and everything like that. But, I mean, I can't imagine doing anything else. Like, I tried. I tried to get an office job, a 9-to-5, and I've made a little bit more money doing that, but I had to start flying again because I missed it so much. We have a term in the industry. It's like the bug gets you. Uh-huh. So if you try to leave, you have to come back because flying, there's something about it. It's just different. Like, I get to go to a new place, you know, 2 nights a week, and my schedule is actually really good. I'm gone for 3 days, and then I'm off for 4 days.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. And I'm sure pilots feel the same way. Most of the pilots are in it. They're so passionate about being up in the air.
Yeah, it's definitely a passion. Like, it's just different. People think that we're just, you know, serving Cokes and peanuts and stuff.
Yeah.
But we are, but we're trained to, like, do a lot more than that. And I've already had to put my skills to the test with, you know, like a medical emergency on board or turbulence, you know, so anything could happen. Mm-hmm. And we're not just there to serve peanuts and pretzels.
You know, that's funny because our friend of the family was Southwest. She had to do the same thing. A gentleman had a heart attack and they really and truly saved his life right there on the aircraft. Was yours that dramatic?
It was. Yeah. I don't want to get into it too much, but it was pretty dramatic. And I'm glad that we had the training that we did because it really kicks in. And they always say that. They're like, oh, don't worry that you're going to forget it. Like, the adrenaline kicks in and you do, you know, you're there in the moment and you do what you have to do to help that person.
Sure.
You know?
All right, Chelsea. Well, thanks so much. We're going to have Mal Vincent a little bit later on giving a review on the movie Sully. I haven't seen it. I'm dying to hear his review of it. But speaking of flying, good luck to you. All right, Annette, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hi there. How are you today?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm just fine. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you just fine.
I have a dream job, and I am so passionate about it because it took me away from a 10-year job that I spent 30 years in. Is that passionate enough?
Wow. My producer was talking to me, and I could not hear that last comment. What'd you say, Annette? Sorry, Morgan.
I was working in a field for 30 years that I really, really enjoyed, but this particular job drew me away.
Wow. My goodness. What was the job and what is the job?
I've been working as a school teacher for 30 years, working with children who are very smart and also children who had struggled.
Nice.
But the problem was that the children who fell between those cracks, the ones who had real smart, but also had struggled, were not getting helped. We call them twice exceptional.
Oh,
the problem was they were truly being ignored. And my own sons fell in that category, and they struggled in school, and there was no help for them. Tutoring doesn't work for that group of people. So I found a business, and I brought it to Virginia. I'm the first one to do that 10 years ago. And my husband and I have run this business for 10 years. I train students, children, and adults. I own the business, and I run it, and it's the best thing I've ever done. How many school teachers do you know that jump out of teaching from tenure jobs? I did.
Yeah, okay. All right, Annette. Well, thank you. That's very interesting. We appreciate the call. We've got Brittany on the line. Hi, Brittany. You got a dream job?
I do have a dream job. Hi, Joe.
How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. I actually was Derek Bort's producer many moons ago at Wavy TV when he was breaking into being on air. I taught him a lot of things and watched him, and it's such a joy to see him succeeding in his dream. And then I went on and actually worked with you, Joe, and anchored news.
I know who you are now, Brittany. How are you?
Yes, I'm doing great, my friend. And now I have my true dream job.
Yeah, I see. Mary Kay sales is really your dream job?
You know, if anyone had told me that, Joe, when I was becoming a broadcast journalist, I never would have believed it. But I think it's everything I always wanted and never knew I needed. When I became a journalist, it was because I really wanted to help people. I wanted to impact their lives in a positive way. And it wasn't all I thought it would be, quite honestly. And I watched people go onto the network and thought that that might be me. And out of the blue, this opportunity fell in my lap, and it's given me the opportunity to both mentor women and help them impact positive financial change in their lives. And it really is my dream because I get to be with my family, I get to travel, and I get to watch people's lives change right in front of my eyes. And that's why I became a journalist. So I learned a lot from that, but I think God was calling me in a different direction, and I'm now using my leadership gifts to pursue my dream and help others do the same.
Oh, that is terrific. Brittany, it is so good to talk to you. Really appreciate your calling in.
Hey, great to talk to you, my friend. Be well.
Thank you. You too. You still there, Joe?
Yep, still here.
How about, you know, opportunities in baseball? What are some of the jobs that young people coming up can apply for and hold in baseball?
You know, there's baseball is such a big business nowadays. There's a job just about for anyone, whether you're someone that likes working outdoors and, you know, wants to be out there working on the field, enjoying the summertime, or technology and social media is more your thing, and all the, you know, website and, you know, the media along those side of things. And it seems like so many of those beginning jobs are sales. So if you've got a knack for, you know, selling things, there's every team out there looking for somebody that's going to be able to help them sell some tickets.
Just like the sales of beer that I tried with when I was the vendor over there.
Yep. I don't think anybody can fill Willie's shoes, though.
No, Willie's great. Willie's a legend over at Harbor Park. Now, you know, Ian in public relations, that's a whole other stream that every club needs PR. That's a career field, isn't it?
Yeah. Ian definitely has his hands full there setting up, you know, interviews like this, or, you know, maintaining just a daily presence that the team has, you know, whether it is, you know, in the conventional, you know, streams, or, you know, whatever the new emerging technologies are. But, yeah, there's so many different ways to get involved that, you know, if your passion is sports, chances are there's a skill set that's going to match up, you know, perfect for you.
My college alma mater was one of the first schools to have a program in graduate school for sports administration. Ohio University has one of the great programs, I'll say.
Definitely.
As I'm going to homecoming this coming weekend, give a nice plug for Ohio U. What about your background? How did you get your foot in the door to be a baseball administrator?
I started when I was young, you know, 15 years old, working at an LPGA tournament up in Ohio. You know, taking out the garbage, putting up fencing, painting, all the grunt work. And, you know, every year over the summer, I would get more and more responsibility. And by the time I graduated college, they offered me a full-time job. And, you know, I was in charge of all the operations from that tournament. And eventually moved into minor league baseball, became the assistant GM of a single-A team outside of Youngstown, Ohio. And from there, I moved on to becoming GM of a double-A hockey team right in downtown Youngstown. And then it was July of 2008 when I moved down here to take over the Admirals. So definitely, yeah, bounced around a little bit and, you know, had a great career path so far.
So you had a little bit of hockey background, oh, by the way, that led to you're also general manager of the Admirals.
Well, I was GM of the Admirals until Thursday, and then we actually sold. Actually, we didn't own the team anymore. The Edmonton Oilers owned the team, and we were managing them, and Edmonton sold the team. And so my calendar's opened up a bit, but now I can just focus on the Tides, and I finally get an off season after 5 years of doing both.
Like I said, Joe, you are a fantastic administrator when you work for those Norfolk Admirals. They're really going to miss you. I'm sorry. I didn't realize the update there, but it kind of frees your schedule up a little bit, doesn't it?
For sure. You know, it was a week ago today, and the organization's great. You know, had a great run there in the Calder Cup in 2012. And,
yeah.
You know, the rest of the staff is staying out of the room. So I'm looking forward to the home opener next Friday, and I'll get to go down there and buy a beer from one of those vendors and actually be able to enjoy a game and not have to worry about the operation.
All right, Joe. Fantastic talking to you. I really appreciate your calling in today, and have a good one, buddy.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You bet. And Alan's on the line. Alan, go ahead from Chesapeake.
Hey, Joe. I've often envied you it being able to go out and do all these different jobs. But fortunately, I was able to get a job in computers, something that didn't even exist when I was in high school, really.
Uh-huh.
And fell into it in college when electrical engineering didn't work out. Because I was one of those twice indicated people that your previous caller had mentioned. And didn't realize how lucky I was till about a year out of college. They were flying me up to Baltimore to work at an IBM site. And I looked around one night about 8 o'clock. Everyone else had gone. I was surrounded by about $4 million worth of machinery. And I was like, wow. And for baseball, if you remember the movie, there was a guy who used computers and statistics to take a team from L.A. all the way out to the championships. So I encourage people not only to follow their dreams, but know that their ultimate dream job might not exist today, but it could exist tomorrow.
Oh, yeah.
I sure hope someone gets that chief science officer that Mr. Spock filled, that position.
All right.
Waiting for that one to open up.
All right, Alan. Thanks very much. We do appreciate it. Folks, our number 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. And let's go to Wube in Hampton.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Wube?
Love the show.
Great.
Just my story is similar to a lot of people. I have actually, my dream job was something that you used to do, and that's be on television. So I finally got an opportunity to do that. So I guess my little 2 cents worth of advice would be just pursue your dreams, never tell anybody no, and just keep working at it and be patient. I finally got an opportunity to do it after so many years. So.
Oh, that's fantastic. Good advice. Just stick with it, straight ahead, and it'll happen. Thank you, Wube. Let's go to line 3, Barbara, in Urbana. We love Urbana.
Yes, we do love Urbana. my dream job is that I have been able to work in the field of elections for pretty much my whole life. And I have done it locally here in Middlesex County and at the state level and around the world. I've worked elections in Bosnia and Kosovo and Kyrgyzstan and some other countries. And it is what I love.
My goodness. Now, that is a different type of job. Were you in the military? Is that what took you overseas?
No. I was the nerdy kid in high school who handed out political leaflets when other people were going to stock up.
Wow. That
tells you how old I am. And through being interested in campaigns, I got involved in doing, you know, election stuff. I worked as an officer of elections and polls, and then I was on my local electoral board, and I was registrar for 12 years, and then I was not registrar anymore, and when I got the opportunity the first time to go to Bosnia, I didn't have a passport. I'd never been out of the country, and it took me a while, so I missed the very first election out of the war, after the war, but then I went the next year, 1997, and I have done 12 international election missions. I've done voter registration. I've done polling place supervision. I've done area supervision training. It's just been an amazing, amazing trip.
All right, Barbara, you win the award, the most unusual dream job of the day. Thank you so much for calling. And by the way, at 12:53, Mal Vinson's going to weigh in and review the movie Sully. Can't wait. I may go see that this weekend. Line 1, Charles, calling from Virginia Beach. Hello, Charles.
Hey, how's it going, Jeff? Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
So I've had a lot of really interesting jobs. I've worked in historic museums. I've worked in restaurants. I've worked all sorts of stuff. But what I would really, you know, and I'm just turned 40, so one of these days when I ever do grow up, I'd love to be a local radio personality, a DJ, you know, on-air announcer, et cetera.
Wow.
I've always been fascinated with stuff like Tom Ashbrook or, you know, back when, you know, the local morning radio show guys. And I think that those guys just got one of the best jobs in the world. And I've never heard one of them ever tell me that I was wrong.
Did you say you do that, you know, wedding receptions? You're a DJ now?
No, when I say DJ, I mean like an on-air radio.
Yeah,
talent.
And I'm just saying, have you done anything like weddings so far to gain some experience in that?
No, in fact, that's partly why I called. I'd love to get some advice from anybody if that's a genuine direction to go. Sure.
I would worry about the age thing only because, didn't you say you're 40?
Yeah, just turned 40 back in August.
Just that so many of us in this world jump right in out of school and, you know, sweep floors for a while and eventually give the time and temperature at midnight or 3 a.m. and become an intern, and you work your way into a station. It would be a bigger challenge, I think, at your age to come around and find a way in unless you get a great tape going somehow.
Well, then maybe I'll go build a great tape. I appreciate the advice, sir.
And even volunteer at your friendly local favorite station. That's a great way to get in.
Already got my application in there. Thanks for the plug, though.
There you go. All right, Charles, thank you so much, and good luck. Carrie Williamsburg, you're on the line. What's your dream job?
Hello, Joe. I have just been bumped by Santa to tell you you're on the good boy list right now.
Oh, bumped by Santa. You mean like elbowed, like Santa is sitting right there in the room?
Just a little elbow in the rib.
Oh, my God.
I'm in the sewing room at the moment. I'm completing our summer Santa outfits using a nice Hawaiian red and white fabric. But as you can tell, I am Santa's wife.
Wow.
And it truly is a dream job.
You've just given me I got to tell it quickly, though. I was a Santa once at Chuck E. Cheese's when I was out of work in the mid-80s. And get this, after 4 weeks, they paid cash.
I can just see you.
They paid cash, like $400 a week for 4 weeks. It was great money. But who comes in but my dentist with his two children? I didn't have the heart to tell him it was me sitting there. So I actually had to let the dentist do his thing with the kids, and I was Mr. Santa Claus. But where's your husband, Santa Claus?
At Busch Gardens.
Oh, terrific. Terrific. Well, that is a dream job. We really appreciate your phoning in today. Thanks so much, Carrie.
Indeed.
Well, we did touch on the airline industry a little bit with that dream job from the flight attendant, and now I've been waiting to hear my buddy Mal Vincent give us his thoughts on the movie Sully. Mal, it's all yours. Take it away.
I'm going to talk for the few seconds I've given about a movie that you already have declared to be a surprise hit. I say surprise because I expected Sully to be no more than a TV movie released in theaters with a big name star and director. An attempt to stretch a plane crash into a full-length movie seemed to be a challenge. Besides, the outcome is well known. Chesley Sully Sullenberger, who landed the plane in the river in New York City, has become a national celebrity, and all 155 passengers survived, and it has become known as the Miracle on the Hudson. There's no suspense. And at the outset, there seems to be no conflict. In other words, no drama. But the fact is, we need a hero. And we need a movie like this. We're involved in a world in which we hear new threats of violence every day. Boy, do we need a hero. We need a movie like Sully. While I personally thought it was both predictable and rather pat in its approach, I realize why it is so popular. In fact, it was the second biggest opening ever for a Clint Eastwood movie.
I want you to know I did the best I could.
Of course you did. You saved everyone.
People call you a hero.
I don't feel like a hero.
Show us your case, Super Sully!
There's been too much talk in the press already.
I'm overwhelmed by all this attention.
Now here's a local angle, which some of you may know and some may not. Sully the pilot has been seen a lot locally, a lot. I've seen him myself on numerous U.S. Airways flights out of Norfolk, mostly en route to Charlotte. Talked to veteran U.S. Airways workers at the airport, and one of them told me, yes, it was a miracle. The odds were heavily that plane would have sunk fast if it landed in one piece. Sully was one of those pilots who often came out of the cockpit to welcome the passengers and to introduce himself as the pilot. Just a quick appearance, but you remember him. He said he hoped you enjoyed the flight, and yes, you felt comfortable. But of course, I wouldn't have thought anything of it until he became famous, and I connected the pilot and the U.S. Airways thing with what happened nationally. For me, he was always on flights on the East Coast, mostly to Charlotte, once to Pittsburgh. I thought he looked a little like Walt Disney with the mustache. He also looks a lot like Tom Hanks, which helps because Tom Hanks plays him in the movie.
This was dual engine loss at 2,800 feet, followed by an immediate water landing with 155 souls on board. No one has ever trained for an incident like that.
An element of controversy was added in the last reel when the National Transportation Board was brought in as a kind of villain to challenge Sully's decision and to suggest that maybe he could have returned to LaGuardia Airport safely.
Our job is to investigate how a plane ended up in the Hudson River.
On the Hudson.
It's not a crash, it was a forced water landing.
Simulation showed that you could make it back to the airport.
Not possible. I felt it go.
The flight, by the way, was on the way from LaGuardia to Charlotte. Ultimately, it was ruled that Sully made the right decision. We're glad, because we badly need a hero who, for a change, makes the right decision. And even though it lacks suspense, we needed a movie like Sully. We have enough tension and bad news outside the theater.
Thank you, Mal. I will go see it this weekend. Looking forward to that one. Hey, we're winding down here briefly. I have all new appreciation for Kathy Lewis and what she does. I always have, but now even more. She is so smooth as silk with this unbelievable hour sitting here in this room. And no, Morgan Chase, Mr. Producer, it hasn't been the longest hour of my life. Kathy and I compared it to an hour-long live shot from TV days. That's more like it for me. But I've thoroughly enjoyed it. A lot of people want to know what I've been up to. I've had now like almost 6 months into this retirement thing, and I've had a lot of travel time going to weddings around the country for nephews of mine. And it's been a blast, and got into a video project that some listeners might find interesting. It's just pretty much a family video for our old friend Paul Webb, who was the former basketball coach at Old Dominion University from 1975 to 1985. Paul and his wife, Charlotte, are celebrating 67 years of marriage tomorrow, and they are in such great shape. And I've been over there about 15 times shooting, say, 300 pictures from their photo albums and planning this whole thing for Christmas. They now have 31 members in their family. That's how large that family has grown. They have more great-grandchildren than they have grandchildren. It's going to be a great little project when we're finished, and Paul is so much fun to work with. We have enjoyed every minute of it. And, you know, his interest was baseball. Here he was the basketball coach at Old Dominion, and he was a crackpot shortstop back in his day, played semi-pro baseball, and even had to turn down the Yankees when they asked him to go up to Binghamton, New York, to fill in as a shortstop for 6 short weeks. Paul had to think about it and say, can't do it. Married, 2 children, too many responsibilities. So there you go. Now you know the rest of the Paul Webb story. Congratulations on your marriage, Paul and Charlotte. Folks, I've enjoyed it. This has been big fun for me, and I appreciate the phone calls that have come in and all the comments we've been seeing on social media. And keep those social media comments coming here on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere else, and check out our podcast. Coming up next here on 89.5, What It Takes, Chasing Graduation at High Poverty High School. Morgan Chase, thank you guys so much there in the control room for helping me out on this first run. And I'll ask you from 1 to 10 how I scored. Thanks, everybody. See you next time.